97.7 EXT. We're live at EXT, and we have a real treat for you today. We have a music producer, composer, writer, and performing artist in pop, rock, television, movies, and on Broadway. His name has been attached to notable projects in most of those fields. He was one of the top record producers in the States during the late 60s and 1970s, responsible for pulling together more than a dozen albums that are considered classics, and all of which continue to sell well more than 30 years. Including the band's music from Big Pink, The Band, The Last Waltz, Cheap Thrills by Big Brother and the Holding Company, Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel, The Child is Father to the Man by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and so many others. Please welcome Mr. John Simon.
That's very impressive, Dale. I'm impressed.
What a resume. Mm-hmm. Now, John's going to be joining us at EXT's 11th birthday party at the Egg with Professor Louis and the Chromatics. And you can pick up your tickets right now at exit977.org or at the Egg box office. Now, John, you're a musician yourself from a very young age.
Mm-hmm. I started playing piano when I was 4 years old. My father was an amateur violinist, a real good one, and so there was always music in the house. And at first he put me on violin, but my mother objected to it as being too scratchy, and I moved to the piano pretty quickly. And I just learned everything that most kids learn who start with classical piano, you know, Scarlatti and Haydn and Mozart and Bach and Beethoven. And I got just so far. When I was in a teenager, I asked my folks if I could please have a piano teacher who could teach me something a little more pop, shall we say, a little more modern. So I got this great teacher. His name was Andy Wuhr, and he taught me stride piano and boogie woogie and how to read lead sheets and how to, the big goal in the sky was to get something called a fake book, which just had the melody and the lyrics for all popular songs, hundreds of them, and you had to supply the piano part with just those basics, and that was something he taught me how to do. So that was it. That's when I got my musical experience. And the first jobs I had were as a teenager, and you know, I used to play all kinds of ethnic weddings with a band that a friend of mine had.
Who were you inspired by? Were you Jerry Lee Lewis, Fats Domino, any of those people? Who were you looking up to when you were playing piano?
Well, I liked Fats Domino, but I really was a jazz snob. I would look down on popular music. I hated rock and roll. It's ironic that my job turned out to be producing rock and roll acts. But mostly I just loved jazz players, and they weren't necessarily piano players. Although Horace Silver came from my same hometown, and one of my brushes with fame was that for this very same job backing the stripper, the drummer had been Horace Silver's drummer before he left town. So I was very active musically through junior high and high school and college, etc.
Yeah, you were in bands. You authored musicals while in high school. You went to Princeton University. What did you go there to become?
Rich and famous. No, I went there to be to do something other than high school. When I went there, I took up every musical activity possible, but then I realized how hard college was compared to my high school, which was sort of like Greece. And so I took the easiest major possible for me, which was music. And I became a music major. And at that point, they actually offered jobs to college graduates. Interviewers came. It's hard for kids to believe this today, but interviewers actually came around to the college campus offering jobs to graduates. And I got two job offers. One was to write commercials for an advertising agency, to write Anison commercials. And the other one was to be a trainee at Columbia Records, a much more nebulous opportunity, but one I obviously took. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I took it, because if I hadn't, I would have been writing commercials, and that wasn't much fun.
Junior producer you were at Columbia Records. Explain to us exactly what a record producer is, what role they play in the music creation process.
Well, I got asked this question a lot back then. I used to just say a producer can be just anybody. It can be an arranger, which is essentially what I am, an engineer, a manager, a friend, just another set of objective ears. You know, a partner, just anybody that can give you, the artist, some objectivity, because the artist gets so involved in their project that they really
could, they really welcome somebody on the outside to listen to what's happening and give them an opinion that they trust. Now, some producers, as I say, are engineers. I'm not. I don't know an ohm from a volt. Some producers are arrangers like I am. So what I contributed to all these projects was a sense of the arrangement of the music, the musical, you know, chart and what everybody would play, and to find things that didn't seem to work quite right, and to help the artists with their problems if they, you know, sensed that something was musically wrong but couldn't figure it out. So that's what I did.
And they're a psychiatrist in a sense too, right?
Oh, right. I forgot to mention that. Yeah. Every producer is a psychiatrist, a lay psychiatrist, because artists put a lot on the line when they're when their art is out there being examined and everything, and they need help. And I didn't realize this until, you know, very lately.
A producer is a jack of all trades. Now, oftentimes, you're the first person to hear these songs long before they're recorded, long before radio plays them. Tell us some of the first artists you started producing for. You produced for a variety of genres, a variety of artists, right?
The first act that they gave me to do on my own was Frankie Yankovic and his Polka Kings, America's Polka King. And, well, let's see, the first job where I actually did any real arranging was probably, it was Simon and Garfunkel and Leonard Cohen pretty much the same time. With Simon and Garfunkel, the first one was a band called The Circle.
I wanted to ask you about this one, your first popular success in 1966, this single right here. You remember this one here? That's The Circle. These guys opened up for the Beatles.
They did after this hit. You could hear that organ that just was played.
Yeah.
That was something that I added to it. That was an arrangement addition.
Red Rubber Ball, the name of that song. 1966, your first real big producer credit on that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was thrilled by that. I mean, I had never produced a record before in my life. And I went to my boss at Columbia Records and said, you know, can I have a couple of $1,000 to produce that? And he said, hey, kid, take five. And so I did that, and I produced that, and I heard this arrangement that would include this organ, so I added an organ to it. They didn't have an organ. They were just three of them in the band. So when they had a hit record, they were forced to call up a friend they knew who played the organ so that they could play this song and other songs on tour. And I got to say that when I first heard this song coming out of my car radio after having worked on it, it was the biggest thrill of my professional career, and I've never had a thrill that matched that one.
You're like, this is it.
Yeah. Right? I've accomplished something on a professional playing field, and here, and I couldn't believe it. There it was coming out of the radio, and I knew every speck of that record so well, and there it was coming out of the radio, you know. What a great thrill. It's wonderful.
Does it give you a little chills when you hear it again?
No.
You cringe a little, perhaps.
No, I don't cringe at all. It's a good record, but I can't say I get, you know, chills or thrills from it at this point.
Well, John, you were also one of the Columbia employees present at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, where you met Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And that led you working on a soundtrack to a movie, You Are What You Eat, featuring Peter Yarrow and Paul Butterfield and many others that were on that. That led you to the band. Now, connect the dots here for us.
Okay, that brings us to some local history. I had met Peter because I was recommended for this project that he was in the midst of, this movie. And it really wasn't a movie. It was just cans of film. So I was brought in, and a wonderful man named Howard Alk, who was a friend of Albert Grossman. They're getting into local history here. And Albert Grossman was the manager of Peter, Paul, and Mary, Peter Yarrow's group, and also the manager of Bob Dylan and many others. So Albert was in Woodstock. Peter was in Woodstock. I was brought to Woodstock for the first time. And Howard Alk and I were enclosed in this house where we were supposed to make a film out of all these cans of film. This is before digital stuff. The film was actually on film in cans, metal cans. So they were there one night working, and I heard this god-awful bleeding coming from outside. And it was a bunch of people who were playing on some instruments that they were not quite accustomed to. And they were dressed in these costumes that were sort of, you know, Halloween-y. And I think it was Howard Alk's birthday, and they were serenading him. And these four guys turned out to be four-fifths of what would become the band. Robbie Robertson, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, and Rick Danko. I had produced another project for Albert before, Gordon Lightfoot, which is where I did a lot of arranging. He asked me where I did when I did my first arranging. So I was, Albert knew who I was, and the guys in the band had heard my stuff through Gordon Lightfoot and also the Leonard Cohen stuff that I'd done, the Blood, Sweat, and Tears stuff. So they knew that I was a producer and I was on the scene, and Robbie Robertson, who was and remains a very canny, careful individual, sort of interviewed me to be the producer of the band. It became apparent that they were going to do a record. They were there in Woodstock because they had been Bob Dylan's backup band, and Bob Dylan had a motorcycle accident and was incapacitated, so he got them this house to live in, just a little ranch house in the woods, which they, you know, jokingly called Big Pink. So they were rehearsing in the basement of Big Pink songs that Bob had written and songs that they were beginning to write themselves. And about the time that I showed up, they were ready to produce an album with these songs. And incidentally, when the 50th anniversary of the basement tapes, as they call those recordings from the basement of Big Pink, when that 50th anniversary came out a few years ago, I heard newscasters saying, Levon Helm and the basement tapes. Well, that's not true. Levon Helm was not even there for the basement tapes. He had taken leave of the band because on the first tour backing Bob Dylan, they were all booed by Bob's folky aficionados who couldn't stand the idea of Bob going electric. So Levon didn't like being booed. He went back to the southern United States where he was from. And he actually appeared in Woodstock a day before I did, and he heard the basement tapes a day before I did. Now, if you listen to the basement tapes and then listen to the music on the music from Big Pink album, you'll hear quite a difference. And that difference is what occurred when the guys and I got together and worked on those songs more carefully and polished them so that they would be ready to be on an album. And they were so polished that when we went into the studio to record a demo that Albert Grossman would take around shop to record companies, we did five songs in one day that appeared in that final album, in that version that we recorded in one day, which is pretty remarkable considering that most bands take a week to record one song these days. And that's not an exaggeration.
You remember this one here? Take a load off, Benny. Take a load for free. What a great song.
Take a load off, sure. Benny.
Brings you back?
Sure. You put the load right on me. Now, there's so many things I can talk about that song.
Tell us a little bit about this song here.
Well, this, like I say, Levon wasn't there, so every other song in the album is sung by either Richard or Rick. But at the end of the recording sessions for that day we recorded those five songs, Robbie pulled this song out that I hadn't even heard, and he pulled out an electric guitar. He never had been pulled out an acoustic guitar. He had been playing electric guitar for every other song in the album. And he and Levon had worked this song out for Levon to have a chance to sing the lead vocal. And it's Garth Hudson, who still is a local man living in Kingston, New York, playing all that wonderful piano stuff, and that song in particular. And what else can I tell you? People say, why was that song so popular? And it is the most popular song that album.
Yeah.
I think it's got an easy-to-play pattern for any amateur guitarist who wants to learn the song. It's got a catchy, hooky melody and with that special hook that's repeated at the end. You put the load, then you put the load repeated to back on me. It's got an interesting story, and it's sung in this authentic Southern accent that Levon had when he sang. Now, you have to also realize at this time that everybody making a pop record in those days sang in this authentic, no, not authentic, this sort of universal northeastern or just East Coast accent. If you were British, you didn't sing with a British, with a Cockney accent or whatever accent you were from.
Right.
You sang with this on a universal Eastern U.S. accent. People who were from the South sang with this northeastern accent. Levon didn't.
He
sang with his natural country accent, which you would only find on country and western records.
And this is possibly one of my favorites from that album as well. Boy, I love this one. Chess Fever, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know this one?
Sure.
Organ, so prominent in this one. Just starts off with like a Bach toccata and fugue.
That's right. That's Garth Hudson again playing the organ in this one.
Wow. And then it just rips right into a rock and roll song.
Yeah. And this is interesting in from an arranging point of view, because I gave them this arrangement for this song, but they had been playing this song so much with the old arrangement that when they went out on the road, they went back to the old arrangement they were more comfortable with. And in subsequent band albums, like the Rock of Ages album and times when they played live, you hear the old arrangement, not this arrangement.
Interesting. Interesting. So when these guys brought this music to you that it would eventually become music from Big Pink, were they completely different? Very similar to what we now know and love?
Similar, sure, similar. But we touched them up. We worked together on everything. There wasn't a single note on any of these recordings that all six of us didn't agree on putting out there.
You were the extra member of the band, because Robbie Robertson told a critic in Rolling Stone a long time ago that for the band recordings, John Simon was that outside ear and outside opinion you could trust.
Well, I'm glad he said that. That's a nice compliment, and I was glad to be able to do that. I mean, it was one of the best periods of my life in a working situation. I wanted to join the band, but as Robbie said, we already have two piano players, you know? So there it was. And Garth and I played all the horns together, and we overdubbed the horns, and that was a unique horn sound, too, because they weren't really polished like most, you know, horn parts are. They were very rough and down homey, you know.
But they really trusted you, and you spent more time with these guys than any other artists that you worked with.
I did, because we became close friends, and I moved to Woodstock, and we became neighbors, and it was very different. It was more of a lab, you know. We took each song and just, you know, took it apart and said, what can we do to improve this, and what's working, what isn't working. You know, so I never imposed my will and said, do this way. It was just a question of, you know, this is working, let's keep it. This is not working, let's fix it.
Well, those are some big years for you, 1967, 1968. Not only did you produce music from Big Pink, but Cheap Thrills by Big Brother and the Holding Company, Child is Father to the Man by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Dream a Little Dream of Me by Mama Cass, and Songs of Leonard Cohen. Let's hear some of your work right here. How about this one?
You know you got it. If it makes you feel good.
What a talent, huh?
Yeah.
Just an incredible. How was she to work with? Janis Joplin.
Janis, I used to say her outside was coated with patchouli and her inside was coated with Southern comfort. And she was a talented, gifted person and a tough cookie. And there were, you know, there was always excitement and a brouhaha around Janis. She was not a pacific, quiet person. There was always something going on. And, you know, my heart goes out to her, because when, before she was incredibly famous, she could walk around Golden Gate Park in her native San Francisco and say hi to friends, and they'd say hi to her, hi, Janis, et cetera. But once she was on the cover of magazines around the world, she couldn't leave her hotel room without being besieged by nutcases who wanted to, you know, to see her, touch her, whatever. And so, as with so many pop stars, that led to her seeking some kind of refuge unadvisedly in drugs and eventually to her demise.
Now, was she difficult to work with? Did you show up and just to do a job, and you weren't really close to her as you were with the band, right?
No, I wasn't. This was more of a, okay, here's the deal.
Let's hear the deal, John.
They were a big hit in San Francisco, and it was hoped that they would do a live album. And all the publicity that Columbia Records put forth was Janis and her band, Big Brother and the Holding Company, are working on a live album in San Francisco. Albert Grossman, her manager once again, and I went out to San Francisco to hear what the band was like live. And we went to a show, and they were full of energy, and the crowds were going crazy for them. But as I suspected might be the case, there were mistakes aplenty. And whereas mistakes are forgotten seconds later in a live performance, mistakes live forever in an album. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think they wanted those mistakes to be there forever. And
You didn't want to be attached to it.
Yeah. So what we did was we made a fake live album. The album, Cheap Thrills, is made to seem like it's a live album. There's only one song in the album that is live.
Which one's that?
That's Ball and Chain. Mm. Everything else was done in the studio. And we threw
some crowd noise in there.
Yeah, exactly. Threw crowd noise in there. But, you know, if you listen carefully, you know that it isn't an album because one of the songs, Turtle Blues, is just a few of us playing in a studio and trying to actually replicate a bar rather than a big concert hall. So,
did it take a lot of takes to get that album going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the song Summertime, which, you know, aside from Peace in My Heart, may even be the most played song from that album. Summertime is the song from Poor Game Best by the Gershwins, and she wanted to do it because it's a beautiful song and everybody knows it. But the guys in the band wanted the introduction to sound like Bach. No, it's one thing to want it to sound like Bach, but to make it actually follow those rules, it takes a little work. So I had to, you know, educate's a tough word. I had to work with them and sort of, show them what it was that they had to do to make it sound more like a Bach fugue, which is what they wanted it to do. They wanted it. So, you know, I told them, you know, so it's if it's in one key, it was in A minor, that the chords to the notes to a simple A minor chord are A, C, and E. So try to hit an A, C, or an E on the downbeat of each measure in these little lines that you're playing. And then, you know, we just followed this pattern. Each time we'd start every session off by woodshedding, rehearsing that introduction to Summertime. And by, you know, the 20th or time or so, that's not an exaggeration,
because
a lot of money was spent in making these albums at that time. It started to sound like, it's starting to sound like they've worked out something like a real Bach fugue, and it isn't dissonant. It sounds together, and so let's just start to roll tape, and that's what we did, and that's when we started recording Summertime.
Oh, Susan,
John, you remember this one here?
Oh, sure.
She leads you to the river. She is wearing
songs of Leonard Cohen. This is Suzanne.
From Salvation
Beautiful song.
Army
counter. Judy Collins recorded this one in 1966. Was 67 when Leonard recorded it for his debut. You took over producing that album from John Hammond, who actually got sick. So you were, by default, the album's producer. And you and Leonard really didn't see eye to eye, I understand.
That's wrong.
That's wrong?
Yeah, that's misinformation.
Fake news.
Yeah, fake news.
So, set the record straight.
This
tell us about
really
this.
Was, that really is fake news. Leonard was staying in the Chelsea Hotel, a famous hotel in New York City, and he said to me that John would schedule the session and then have to reschedule it a month later, and whether he was sick or not, I don't know, but Leonard and I got along just great.
You did?
Oh, just great. Yeah, he was a wonderful guy, and I respected him so much because he was already a published poet and a little older than most of the people I was working with. And
I heard that he wanted his recording to be very sparse, and you wanted a little more orchestration on it, and that was the clash between you two.
Well, no. I mean, he may have started off wanting it more sparse, but he was happy with most of the things I added. What I principally added was that the girls singing in the background. Instead of strings or horns, I used women's voices because so many of his songs were either about women or directed to women. Mm. So I thought that that presence would add to the album, and I think it worked great. A couple of times, in the end, he wasn't happy with what I'd done, and that's just fine. That's what the artist did, and but we weren't angry about it. He said he wanted to go and redo some of the songs, which he did, but he didn't do them sparsely. He brought in a band, I think they're called Kaleidoscope, added things like bouzoukis and, you know, other instruments.
We're live at EXT with John Simon here. He's going to be a part of EXT's 11th birthday party, Friday, July 6th at the Yag with Professor Louis and the Chromatics. And John's going to be talking with his book, his brand new book that's coming out later this year, Truth, Lies, and Hearsay, a memoir of a musical life in and out of rock and roll. Tickets are available right now at exit977.org or the Yag box office, 518-473-1845. Now, sometime after that Leonard Cohen album, John, you were called back to do the band's second album, their self-titled album, and they loved you so much, they wanted you back. You remember this one here? What do you think about when you hear these songs back again?
Well, you're playing the greatest hits from all these albums.
I am.
I remember a lot of the other ones, too, and very fondly, too. This is interesting. When an artist puts together their first album, they have a backlog of songs all ready to go. When their album's a hit and the record company is saying, we need another album right away, they're caught short. They have either their second-rate songs that didn't make it to the first album, or they've got to write a lot of songs in a hurry. They didn't give them the second-rate songs, but they had to write a lot of songs in a hurry. So whereas the first album was done very quickly in just a few recording sessions, for this one, we rented a house in California, in L.A., because it was wintertime in Woodstock, and everyone living up here in this neck of the woods knows that if you have an option to get away in January and February, it's not a bad idea. So we got away, and we went out to a house in Hollywood. And we had no engineer. We had our own equipment in the pool house of this house, and we all lived in the house itself, which had actually belonged to Sammy Davis Jr., the great entertainer. And Robbie, who did most of the writing for this album, set about writing there in the house. And so he was writing songs, and as he was writing them, we were figuring out the arrangements and taking him into the studio and working on them. So as opposed to doing four or five songs in one day, and this one, it took us 2 or 3 days to do each song, and sometimes even longer, because we had, you know, the songs were not quite written. We had, we were working on them before they even got in front of a microphone. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. We had a lot of famous people would come by and visit, because then by now the Music from Big Pink album was a big success and the band was sort of famous and respected among entertainment people. And people were coming in all over the place, and it's hard to get work done sometimes. And then Albert Grossman, who was the managing them too, said, and to the producer Antonioni, I think his name was Michelangelo Antonioni, was Italian director, actually, was coming to hear the band because he had a new movie coming out called Zabriskie Point, and he was considering the band to provide music for it. So he came, and we had finished about a half of the album, and he came. He spoke no English, and he's listening to these songs, with double entendres and in slang in English, and they don't know any English at all. And he's just sitting there listening, and just deadpan. And then comes a song across the Great Divide, and Richard Manuel sings, "Standing by your window in pain, pistol in your hand," and Antonio jumps up out of his seat and sticks, makes a gesture with his hand and goes, "Pistole, pistole." He knew pistol, but we didn't get the job anyway. But
you didn't get the job.
No, but it was a funny story.
But that album, just as good as their first album, every song on there. Just amazing, amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's travel down the greatest hits path here. I mean, there's this one here as well. Boy, that's a great one. So it took quite a long time to put this second album together as compared to the first.
Yes, it did.
But you made sure every little bit of it was just right before releasing it?
Sure. It's going out under your name, and it's you only get one chance to do it, you know, so, you know, if you don't have to compromise, then don't. We actually didn't have time to finish this in California because they were scheduled to do a concert live in Winterland. I think it was Winterland, up in San Francisco. So we think we were two or three songs short. We went back to New York City and did Jemima Surrender and Whispering Pines, and I think that was it.
Also in 1969, you worked on a soundtrack to an album, to a movie called Last Summer. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
This is funny because they said to me, it would be great if you could get some stars to be in the soundtrack. So I had this R&B kind of song I wrote called Lay Your Love on Me, and Wilson Pickett was hot, so I went to Wilson Pickett and played the song for him, and he said, yeah, I'll do that song. I said, how much do you want to do? And he said, $20,000. Well, the budget for the whole recording of the album was $20,000, so I had the choice of either doing away with that concept of using Wilson for the record, or else having the entire score be Wilson Pickett singing this one song a cappella. So I was forced to pass.
Yeah. Who's this playing?
Me.
This is all you.
Well, this instrument is me, but it's Levon and Rick, I think.
Really?
I have to look at the album to see who it is. Yeah, we played on each other's stuff all the time. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
That was it. But the instrument that I'm playing, that funny thing going, was a concept that Garth Hudson showed me. It's an instrument called a ruxacord going through some kind of a device. Oh, Garth's always been big on devices and technology and still is today. I mean, his rig, when he goes out to play someplace, unless it's just a special concert on the piano, you know, it's the size of two mattresses of outrigger stuff, you know.
Yeah. Wow, pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty impressive. Now, in 1970, Paul Simon urged you to record your debut album called John Simon's Album. You know, this one here.
The thought of it makes your heart rejoice.
Who's that? Just hold on a second.
Don't you think?
Oh, yeah, right.
That you might be on the brink. Disappointment, because nobody knows.
You're cringing.
Ooh, I'm cringing because, yeah. I just sort of sang from my boot tops at that point. I wasn't really, it was all emotion and no care about singing in tune or anything like that. And I have people who say, boy, I love the way you sang in that album. And I've done four or five albums since then. I did two back there in the 72, and I did a couple more in the mid-80s. And then when I did my second batch of albums, I really cared about singing, and I sang in tune. And some people say, I don't like the way you sang in tune. I like the way you sang back then when you were just singing just all raw like that. Well, whatever.
Here's the other one. This is from your second album from 1972 called Journey. Living in a Land of Sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
You know your house won't float away. No, it won't.
I like that. Really jazzy.
Yeah.
You playing all the instruments in this one?
Oh, not at all. This is all live.
This is all live?
All live. That's just me at the piano singing and playing, and Dave Sanborn playing the alto sax, and Howard Johnson playing the baritone sax, and Randy Brecker playing the trumpet, and my old high school friend Dave Pope playing the clarinet, and Dave Holland playing bass, and Dennis Whitted playing drums. Did I leave anybody out? I don't know. But it was all a live band in the studio that I was most familiar with, the old one from Columbia Records.
Studio B?
Studio A. Yeah,
Studio
big,
A.
Big one from
Lincoln. How long did it take for you to record this album here?
2 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have to teach these other guys your songs?
These are all great musicians who could read anything you stick in front of them.
You wrote the music.
I wrote all the music and stuck the music in front of them. They played it all. We did maybe two takes on each song, maybe three takes. And these are jazz guys. Jazz guys can do pretty much anything you stick in front of them.
Mm.
And so there it was.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, I like that album a lot, too.
Yeah, it's great. During the 70s, you worked with David Sanborn and John Hartford and Steve Forbert, who's been by here many times, and Christine Lavin as well, John Sebastian, who's been here. You were the music producer of both the legendary concert and the album, The Last Waltz. And boy, that was an incredible show. It was an incredible feat by you, who was the conductor, the musical director, the person who was the glue.
I was the musical wrangler.
The wrangler, that's the word I'm looking for.
That's the word you were looking for.
Because that was a circus, right?
It was a...
Tell us a little bit about that.
The concept was that the band would be the backing band for their favorite artists. Great idea. And everybody they called up accepted. And the only problem, well, one of the problems was that the guys in the band didn't read music, except for Garth Hudson. So it was my job to... tell them what was going on, you know.
And tell us how you did that.
Well, we met with, before the concert, we met with two artists a day in the band studio in California, you know, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And the guys, each act would say, well, this is the song I want to play. And if it was like Van Morrison was going to do Caravan. So I wrote on a piece of paper what the chords were, you know, not in music notation, just in letters, and gave the guys in the band those pieces of paper, and they read off them for rehearsals. And as we, you know, practiced it some more, they started memorizing it pretty much. By the time we got it down to the show, I had it down to hand signals, you know, like I held three fingers sideways in the shape of a letter E. That meant there was an E chord coming up. If I made my hand into a C, that would be a C chord, or an A. Upside down V with one finger across is an A. And, you know, touch the top of my head, that means go back to the top of the song. And, you know, these are just things that you get used to doing if you're a musician with other musicians that communicate. The one thing that was hard was that Joni, I love this story, Joni Mitchell came and she always tunes her guitar into strange tunings and comes up with strange chords. So I was looking at her left hand to see what the chords were so I could translate them and tell the guys what they were. I couldn't figure them out. I said to Joni, you know, what are these chords? And she said, I don't know the names of them. She said, I tune my guitar this way to make myself stupid. In other words, she was such a schooled musician, you know, she knew if she tuned her guitar to any, you know, standard tuning, she'd be a slave to those cliches. And instead, she tuned it to strange tunings and just experimented and said, oh, this is a funny sound. I don't know what it is, but it's, and you know, I'm stupid. I don't know what this chord is, but it works great, so I'm going to use it.
With that show, Dr. John, Eric Clapton, Ronnie Hawkins, Van Morrison, Ringo Starr, Neil Diamond, a who's who of rock and roll back in the day, there at that show. The finale, this one right here. Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released. Everybody's up on stage playing this one, singing along to this one. From the west out to the east. Of course, the drug du jour was cocaine at that time, right? And there was cocaine aplenty.
Yeah, now, I didn't get indulge in that because someone had to be in charge. I mean, I had heard, cocaine's never been a favorite of mine. I had heard that cocaine was employed by the German army in either the First or Second War extensively because it made good soldiers who would follow directions, you know, with a lot of energy.
Mm.
And so what I had in my hand, for the most part, I can't say that everyone was snorting cocaine, but what I had in the most part was a bunch of good soldiers with a lot of energy. So, and so it's able to, you know, like I say, be the wrangler or be the ringleader in a circus and sort of get everybody to be doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know.
And these guys were playing songs a little bit faster.
you might say. Now, that's another thing about the Last Waltz album is that that's another fake live album.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, Richard, as a piano player, was hitting a lot of cracks. Rick's bass was out of tune. Robbie and Garth both were perfectionists who saw the opportunity to change their parts a little bit. A lot of the singing was inaccurate. It was once one of those things where it was just so exciting and everyone was having such a great time that, you know, if it was to go out in a record, it wouldn't be so great. So everyone redid their parts on top of the drum track, because Levon refused to change anything. So Levon was 100% true and authentic. His vocals and his drumming and whatever mandolin playing he played, those were true. Everybody else, for the most part, was done over. And the horns were balanced badly, and so we did all the horns over again in New York. And plus, you know, Robbie realized that Robbie was the architect of this concert, and you know, he merits great respect for that. But he realized he was a little short on people of color and women, because all he had was Muddy Waters on the one hand and Joni Mitchell on the other. So he got the Staple Singers and Emmylou Harris to do some of their songs on a sound stage in Hollywood with a lot of dry ice smoke. You know, when you look at the video, you can see a lot of smoke coming up, and those obviously weren't on the stage of the Last Waltz concert. So I tell people, you know, the movie is not a documentary of a concert. It's a film about a concert. And the main stars did not overdub themselves. They were all live. I'm wrong in saying that Levon was the only live element. Levon and all the guest stars were live, but all the other four guys in the band touched up their parts.
Now, John Simon, you also wrote some serious music for Broadway, TV, and radio through the late 70s and 80s, and you've kept your hands involved in music and writing and performing and producing as well.
This is a deep interview. You're going to get to the songs I whistle when I'm walking down the street. I didn't do anything to much success there. I mean, I worked on a few Broadway shows in some capacities, but, you know, basically my stuff has been in recording studios.
Well, you're a very good dabbler. You've dabbled in a lot of different things.
Thank you, Dave.
And you've had time to reflect on the past, and you've written a new book. It's coming out this fall, Truth, Lies, and Hearsay, a memoir of a musical life in and out of rock and roll. Lots of juicy tidbits, and I'm sure we're going to hear some on the stage of the YAG on July 6th when you're there.
I like to tell stories. I'll tell some stories.
I can't wait. Can't wait. Have you seen the role of the record producer change over the years? Is it still a significant role today as it was then?
You know, I'm an antiquarian. I really can't tell you too much about music today. I can still say that the producers still have to be psychologists, and there are producers who put their seal and their on the records they produce. And some things have definitely changed. I mean, now they used to be album oriented. You would make an album which had about 22 minutes of music, six songs on each side, and you paid great attention to the sequence of the songs.
Right.
Now it's all one song at a time.
Right.
You know, you download a song that you like, and you also find several producers on one song, because the different producers or arrangers or engineers will layer different things on a piece of music that they've heard and they're hired to do. You see, music has changed so much. It used to be, and you can pinpoint this pretty much maybe 1966 or something like that. You can tell a difference in the Beatles, for instance. The Beatles' first record, I Want to Hold Your Hand, or Meet the Beatles, was just a documentary recording of what they did live. They went into the studio, got in front of a bunch of microphones, and did exactly what they did live. Done. Then through a series of events, which I document in this book that I wrote, multi-track recording came about, which meant that there were a lot of tracks all of them to record on, and artists who had the ability to think beyond just whatever they did on stage, artists like Simon and Garfunkel, and the Beatles later on. When you get to the, you know, like Sgt. Pepper album, it's not just the four of them in front of a microphone. It's layers and layers of different stuff, and so records change forever. And that's what you've got today. You've got all these layered things. The other big change is that music and records and recordings used to be a blind idiom. It was only something that went into your ears. Once MTV showed up and there were music videos, all of a sudden it became a total experience, and what you saw on TV became as important, or not as important as the song, but as supportive to the song as the instruments that were made up the arrangement. Then, consequently, when an artist appeared live, they were expected to do the same kind of visual spectacular that was in their videos. And so you got lots of jobs for dancers and, big screens so everyone could see what was going on. So everything changed completely. So the person who's a music fan today has to really stretch their mind, or maybe shrink their mind, back to what music used to be like in, say, the 1960s.
Are you listening to any music nowadays? Anything that you turn your ear to and go, boy, that's good?
Yeah, stuff will come up. I don't listen. I don't go out to listen. I don't listen a lot for new stuff. Some friend will turn me on to something that's pretty good. And generally, it's not, what we call rock music. You know, it's from all over the place. I like Brazilian music. I like, jazz. I can't think of anything offhand in the pop realm that's really turned me on.
You know Professor Louis and the Chromatics? You know these guys?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah?
Louis himself, as was under another name, Garth Hudson's assistant and tech helper and engineer for a long time. So I know him very well for a long time.
And he's going to be performing Professor Louis and the Chromatics, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the release of music from Big Pink. 50 years. Hard to believe, right? 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
25th anniversary of the band's reunion album, Jericho, as well as lost band tracks. The Egg in Albany, July 6th. It's a Friday night. It is WEXT's 11th birthday party. And Mr. John Simon right here will be providing insight into working with the band, telling more stories from his new book, Truth, Lies, and Hearsay, a memoir of a musical life in and out of rock and roll. Tickets are on sale right now. Contribute to this radio station, exit 977.org. You can also go to the Egg box office, 518-473-1845, and online at theegg.org. There is so much more we could talk to you about. You have so many stories. We could sit here for hours. We could sit here for days. You want to come back tomorrow?
Well,
we do this. We could pick up from 1972, 1973 onwards.
You'll have to provide pizza.
No, I can do that.
Okay.
You like pizza?
No.
Well, you've said it all. Yeah, you've done it all.
That was sort of flip. I'm sorry. Yeah, there's some pizza I like. Yes, indeed.
Well, there's so much more we could talk about. We just touched on a little bit. We'll hear more on the stage of the Egg on Friday, July 6th, WEXT's 11th birthday party. Mr. John Simon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Dave, it's been a pleasure. And I'll sing some songs there at the Egg, too, because I love to put my songs out there, too.
Excellent, excellent. And you can check out johnsimonmusic.net. That's John's website, johnsimonmusic.net. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure.